Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Maxwell's House is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Maxwell's House with Ray Maxwell and Dr. Kiki Sanford. Episode number 74, Where Am I? Part 2.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode. Episode number 74, in fact, of Maxwell's House. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this is Ray Maxwell.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you this week?
I am fine. This week, we're going to pick up where we left off on navigation. We're going to talk about radio navigation. So this is Where Am I? Part 2.
Part 2. I love it. So radio navigation, that's using radar, using radio to I'm interested to find out all the information about this.
Yep. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of different ways of navigating with various avionics and electronic devices.
Cool. Did you have news for us for the beginning of the show to start us off? Is there anything that we need to know?
Absolutely. The news this week was there was a gun-carrying pilot, and there is a program with after they've had a certain kind of training where pilots are allowed to carry a gun and, you know, as a kind of last-stand defense of the cockpit. And there was a gentleman who had taken this course and was carrying a gun, and just before or immediately after, I'm not sure which, but near boarding the aircraft, he was threatening to harm himself because a flight attendant girlfriend had broken up with him.
Oh.
And he was distraught.
That's just no good.
No. So then, given that piece of news, I got the following questions. Question. Do pilots have to pass a psychiatric exam?
Similarly to NASA astronauts, I mean, this is kind of in the vein of the astronaut who drove across the country to get back at the boyfriend, the jilted lover story. I mean, oh, people, I feel sorry for them, but
I know it's a high stress job, but, you know, we have to separate our other activities from our flying activities. And of course, all the passengers want a cool, calm, collected, rational person up there in the cockpit.
Right. Maybe they should treat it as, what is it, Shavasana in yoga, or when you go to yoga, what do they say? You know, just let everything go in your life. Just put it away. Don't think about it. You're here to focus on this one thing right now.
Right. We want you 100% focused on flying the airplane. And love affairs that you've been having in the last week or whatever. Anyway, they were able to get this gentleman under control and talk him down. And the answer to the question is that there is not a specific psychiatric test that is given to pilots, but there are questions that you have to answer. And one of them is, have you had any difficulty in those areas? And if you have, then you have to go through, further testing and whatnot. So, yes, they do ask you if you have had any kind of mental problems in the past. And if you have, they will test you further. But they don't, as a matter of course, send you to a psychiatrist and question you in depth. So there you are.
I wonder if that's something that is, if it is necessary, if it is something that, I mean, we do put our lives in the hands of these few individuals who fly the planes, but you know, it's the disastrous consequences of something going wrong in an airplane are much, you know, they're bigger than say a bus driver or some, right. You know, we don't do psychological profiles for bus drivers. You know, is it
right?
Is although, it something that's although necessary? They,
both of those professions do random drug testing,
right?
And the courts have ruled that they can do that, given the responsibilities that they have.
Yeah.
So in the U.S., so
you're responsible for people's lives,
right? Yes. So you shouldn't be on any illicit drugs while you're performing your duties.
Yes.
But no, it would be interesting. And of course, they do heavy psychiatric exams of the NASA candidates.
Yeah.
For a whole bunch of reasons. And as we know, one slipped through.
And there are probably, I mean, how do you test for the psychotic break that occurs when you've been jilted by a lover? You know, how does that, how do you put that through testing? I mean, somebody be calm, cool, collected about everything and just pass tests with flying colors in terms of their ability to deal with stressful situations. But that is like a primal emotion that,
right.
You know, how do you test for that? That is a question for a psychiatrist. But
yeah, how do you handle rejection by a significant other? I don't know. I don't think they've invented the test that definitely, handles that one.
Yep.
Anyway, I'll go on to my next question that I got in the email. It was, what kind of gas does a conventional piston-powered airplane burn? And can you burn ordinary car gas in a airplane? And the answer to that is that there isn't a great deal of difference. But the main difference is the aviation gas has been tested for what they call vapor pressure. Because if you go to high altitudes, go up to 10,000 feet, you don't want the fuel to vaporize, cause a vapor lock in any part of the fuel system, and that can happen. So they test the fuel that goes into airplanes to see that it has a vapor pressure that is compatible with flying at high altitudes. Now, it turns out that you can burn, under a special permit, you can burn aviation fuel, car gas that you'd buy at a local filling station in an airplane. It's been done, providing you perform a test on that fuel to see what its vapor pressure is. And there are little devices you can buy that you can vapor test fuel with. And in fact, there was a time when out at Hope, where I fly gliders, we were unable to buy fuel on the airport. The airport had a older fuel tank that was underground, and the environmental people found out it was leaking into the ground, and they condemned the whole fueling system at that airport. And it took them the better part of a year to replace that fuel system at this small airport. And so during that time, the glider club bought ordinary, what they call MoGas, or gas for cars. And we had our own little truck that we carried these 50-gallon drums around in. And we had to test our own fuel to make sure that the vapor pressure met the requirements of our flying. Now, keep in mind that our tow planes don't fly very high. They usually only tow a person up to 2,000 or 3,000 feet. So they're not climbing up to 10,000 feet most of the time. So that was a very good use of normal fuel. Now, as soon as the airport was able to provide aviation fuel back at the airport, we went back to that more for convenience than anything else. So we didn't have to pump our own gas.
Is there is the octane important? So the octane
isn't that much different. Most of aviation fuel is now what we call 100 octane low lead, and that is the most common fuel for piston fired airplanes. At one time it was 80 octane, actually 80-87 they called it, which meant it was somewhere between those. If you look at the octane rating at most filling stations, you know, you're looking at 90 or more.
Yeah, I put 91 in my car. So
yeah, so there isn't a big difference in octane.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another question from our listeners said, is the space shuttle a glider? And is it a glider in space? And where does it make the transition? So the truth of the matter is, when it comes in for a landing after it's entered our atmosphere, it is a glider. It doesn't have what we call a very high L over D ratio, lift to drag ratio. That's the way we specify how good a glider can perform. Most of the gliders I fly run between 30 and 50 to 1. So that means for every 1 foot that they drop, they go forward. If it's 40 to 1, they would go forward 40 feet. So if you were at 5,000 feet or 1 mile up, you could glide 40 miles. So that's a very, very shallow glide angle. I don't know what the glide angle of the space shuttle is, but I would guess it's, you know, like 3 to 1 or something. It's very, right. very steep. And now when it comes out of space, it isn't a glider. It basically places his heat shield in front, which is the whole bottom of the space shuttle, and it re-enters the atmosphere at just the right angle, and they have to get that angle just right, or it will skip off of the atmosphere and go back into space, and if it goes in too steep, it will overheat. So they have to get the angle that it's coming back into the atmosphere set very correct, you know, very carefully before they re-enter the atmosphere. And when it first comes in, it's just the bottom of the space shuttle is dissipating a very high quantity or high temperature as the friction, because it's coming in at incredibly high Mach speeds, and the friction of the air particles high in the atmosphere cause it to heat up very rapidly, and it has to dissipate that heat, and then eventually it goes from this falling hot object into the atmosphere and becomes a glider. So, yes, it's a glider. Doesn't have a very good L over D ratio.
Cool.
And speaking of gliders, I'm going to tell a short story that happened here in Canada, and everybody refers to it as the Gimli glider. This was a airliner. I believe it was a 767, but I'm not certain of that. It could have been an Airbus. But at any rate, it was an airliner that was leaving one of the places back east, like Toronto. And the flight dispatch and the captain said, put on X amount of fuel for this flight. And somehow in the translation, and this was when Canada was going through its move from imperial units to metric units, somehow the information, when it got transferred to the gas truck, they fueled it in pounds. And by the way, airline fuel quite often is done in a weight rather than a volume measurement. So they, you know, told them to put on, let's say, 50,000 pounds. I don't know what it was. And the pilot intended to put on 50,000 kilograms. Okay. And
oops.
The fueler put on 50,000 pounds.
This is probably American versus Canadian metric versus standard.
Well, this was all done in Canada. All right, but it was at
somebody
the time.
Must have been educated in America. The United States school system is to blame, I'm sure.
Well, to be fair, Canada was imperial units back when. In fact, we measured fuel in imperial gallons, which is not the same as U.S. gallons, to further confuse things.
Yeah, but that's one more level.
Pounds in Canada were the same as pounds in the U.S. And any rate, there was this mix-up. So they, of course, there's 2.2 pounds to 1 kilogram. So they put on less than half the fuel that the pilot had asked for. So as he's coming cross country, I think the flight was on its way to Vancouver, he got over Alberta and both engines quit from running out of fuel. And to further complicate things, the fuel measurement equipment on the aircraft was not functioning. That is, the level measuring equipment. The fuel flow was working, and they had very carefully, quote, checked the tanks before they left. You don't have to have a working fuel gauge to meet the minimum equipment list that must be on the aircraft. So you can fly without a fuel gauge. That's legal. And so they had no indication that they were running out of fuel until suddenly the engines quit. So here they are over Alberta. The engines flame out from lack of fuel. And the captain of this flight was a former glider pilot. And his first officer, I believe, had been based at one time at Gimli, Alberta, which was a former military base, but it had been closed and turned into a drag strip. Now they started heading for this airport because they decided they could make it. And as it came into sight, they suddenly realized that there was a drag race going on at this drag strip, you know, as they're approaching. Now, and there were some kids that were on their bicycles going down the runway. And luckily, the kids looked up and saw this airliner lined up with the airport, turned around and went yelling back to everybody at the drag race, "Look out, there's a plane coming in." And I think they made an announcement over the PA system and got everybody out of the way. And this airliner came in and landed on the drag strip, and nobody was hit. And in fact, the front landing gear collapsed.
Oh, my goodness.
And they rolled to a stop in the middle of a drag race audience. But no one was hurt. No one on the plane, nobody on the ground was injured. And every time that story comes up, it's referred to as the Gimli glider story. So there you have it.
That's an amazing story.
I mean, from
start to finish, all of the things that went into it, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that could have gone wrong, and the fact that it was a good outcome and no one was harmed is truly, truly amazing.
Yay for the gliding ability.
Yes. So, you know, on the one hand, the pilots were cheered for, you know, handling the situation well, but there was hell to pay to explain why they ran out of fuel.
Oh, yeah.
The good news is that from then on, all airline pilots in Canada checked, double-checked, and triple-checked and dipped the tanks and made absolutely certain during this transition period that they had the fuel on board that they wanted. So,
yes.
There you are.
Very good.
So with that brings us back to our topic of navigation, and I'm going to take you through several different electronic navigation methods. Last show, in episode 73, we covered dead reckoning and pilotage. Dead reckoning is using a compass, a clock, plotters on your map, and figuring out where you want to go and figuring out the correct magnetic heading on your compass and how long it should take you to fly there. Pilotage is looking at the world out the window and figuring out where you are on the map that's sitting in your lap. So we've covered those. And today, the first electronic navigation device, and I'm kind of working from the oldest to the most recent, is ADF, Automatic Direction Finder. Now, this was a fairly simple electronic device that was put into aircraft going back to World War II. And what it does, a modern ADF in an aircraft, what it does is it has a directional antenna. And in fact, in the old days, they used to rotate, but now they have found out a way to electronically sense the direction the signal is coming into the aircraft from. So there are no moving parts in current ADFs. But the automatic direction finder, there's an indicator on your instrument panel that tells you what direction a station you're listening to is with respect to the nose of the aircraft. So if you're flying directly towards a radio station. And by the way, a normal ADF, you can listen to broadcast radio stations, AM stations, or you can listen to low frequency stations that are put out there specifically for aircraft navigation. And most of the time they're located on or near airports. But the automatic direction finder tells you what direction the radio station you're listening to is with respect to the nose of the aircraft. So if you tune in a station and identify that you've got the right station, and that's very important, you then turn the aircraft until the needle points straight up on the indicator or at 0 degrees. And if you hold that, you will fly to this station. Now, there's one big drawback to ADF. If you are flying with a crosswind that's blowing you sideways, if you hold the nose of the aircraft on pointed at the station, what will happen is you will not fly directly to the station. If the wind is blowing you sideways, you will drift off to one side and you'll have to keep turning. If you had a wind from the right-hand side of the plane blowing you to the left, you'll drift to the left and you'll have to keep turning to the right slightly to get back to the station. So you'd fly there in an arc rather than flying straight to the station. Now, there is a way to know to fly straight to the station using ADF, and that is you estimate what the winds are, and you take up a heading that's to the right of the heading that would take you direct to the station, and your ADF needle, let's say, will indicate 10 degrees to the right, or sorry, to the left, because your nose is pointed to the right, and you then hold a magnetic heading and wait to see whether the needle moves to the left or the right. Now, if you've chosen the correct amount of crab, we call it, in other words, you're turning into the wind such that you'll follow a path directly to the station, the needle won't change. It'll stay at 10 degrees. If it starts to move to a smaller number there, in other words, if it started to move to the left, remember the wind's coming from the right, that means you're crabbing too much, okay? And if it drifts the other way, you're not crabbing enough, so you have to take up a new magnetic heading. So it's with ADF, it's kind of tricky. You can always just track directly to it, but you'll be flying inefficiently and go into an arc on it. Also, ADF is often used in conjunction with instrument landing systems where you're coming in and there will be a beacon that you tune the ADF in. And as you come down the landing pathway, and I'll explain ILS later here, as you're coming down the approach, when you pass the station, that needle will swing from pointing forward to pointing backwards just as you go over the beacon. So that lets you know where you are on the approach. And usually it's at a specific point on your approach, such as a decision height or something like that. So that's ADF, automatic direction finding. It tells you what direction a radio station you're tuned into is with respect to the nose of the aircraft. In other words, if it points 90 degrees to the right, and the radio station is off your right wingtip. If it points behind you, you've passed the radio station. If it points directly in front of you, it says, hey, that radio station is up ahead. So that's ADF.
What are the downsides to using the automatic direction finder? I remember last week you talked about wanting to make sure your heads up and looking at what you're doing all the time. Is it one of the direction finders that people rely on too much?
Well, and by the way, that was what they were using to fly that approach in the Polish pilots that crashed in Russia. They were using what's known as a dual ADF approach. Yeah. And we don't know all the details yet, but they clearly went too low. They went below the decision height and hit the trees. And they were not directly lined up with the runway, but they were very near the end of the runway where they crashed. But the ADF can be, it's a low frequency. It's interfered with by certain kinds of storms and static. And again, it shows you what direction a radio station is with respect to the nose of the aircraft.
Yeah.
And when I explain the next method of navigation, you'll see that VOR, visual omni-range, is a better method and does things completely differently than ADF does. So with that, we'll move on to VOR. The visual omni-range is a newer navigation aid that came in back in the post-World War II days. I think it came in the 50s, if my memory serves me correctly. And let me give you a, I'm going to give you a kind of metaphor for how it works. Imagine that we had a rotating light beacon. And imagine that we had a omnidirectional light beacon on the same tower with the rotating beacon. And when the rotating beacon is sending a light beam straight north, we flash the omnidirectional beacon. And they can be two different colors. Let's say we make the omnidirectional beacon a red light. So you can see it in all directions. So when the rotating beacon is sending a light beam straight north, and let's make it green. Now, this doesn't exist. We're just imagining this as a metaphor. But at the time the directional rotating beacon is sending a light beam due north, we flash this omnidirectional beacon, and it's a red beacon. So we could start a stopwatch at the time we see the red beacon flash, and then let's say the just for fun, let's say that it took, this is ridiculous, but let's say it took 360 seconds for the rotating beacon to make one rotation. So we could hit the stopwatch when we see the red flash, and then we could time until we see the rotating green flash. And if it's rotating and makes a full revolution in 360 seconds, if we timed it and we found that it was 20 seconds, we would know that we were on a line 20 degrees from the station, this rotating beacon light station that we've imagined. If we timed 180 degrees, we would know we are due south of the station. So the big difference between ADF and VOR is the VOR tells us what direction we are from the aircraft. And it doesn't matter what direction our nose of the aircraft is pointed. Now, do you understand the difference there? It tells you what direction you are from the station. And instead of telling you where the radio beam is relative to the nose of the aircraft, it doesn't matter what direction the nose of the aircraft is pointed in, as long as you could see. Now, I'm using this metaphor of the light beams. If you could see that flashing light and see the red flash and time till you see the green flash, you could figure out what direction you are from the light beacon, what radial you're on, they call it. Now, in actual fact, the way this works is they send out an omnidirectional signal that is FM modulated, and they send out a directional signal that rotates, and it rotates 30 times a second. It doesn't take 360 seconds to rotate. It's an electronic beam that rotates at 30 hertz, and the omnidirectional signal is sent out in FM modulation, and if you're listening to this AM signal, when it's pointed right at you, you'll get a high-strength signal. When it's pointed away from you, you get next to nothing. So if you compare the phase of these two signals, you can know what direction you are from the VOR. That's the way it actually works. It sends out an FM signal and an AM signal, and you compare the phase of the two. And if they're directly in phase, you're due north of the station. If they're 180 degrees out of phase, you're due south. If they're 90 degrees out of phase, you're east of the station. But the important thing to remember is it tells you what direction you are from the station. So if you want to fly to the station, you fly a reciprocal heading. So in other words, if it tells you you're on the 90-degree radial to fly to the station, you need to turn to 270 degrees to fly inbound to the VOR station. Now, the beauty of this system is if you tune to 270 and imagine that you have a crosswind blowing from the north, blowing you off course, and you set up what they call the CDI, the course deviation indicator, which is how you read these omni signals. You set up and you turn it until the needle centers, and then it tells you whether you're going to the station or from the station, which radial you're on. And from that information, you can then decide what course you're going to follow. If you want to go to the station, you would turn to 270. But if there's a crosswind, very shortly, the needle would go off course and show you that you're drifting. And if you follow the needle, if you're flying two and you've got it set up for a two course, if you turn towards the needle, it will bring you back onto course and cause you to track inbound in a straight line to the station. So that's a VOR. It's a little bit tricky to understand that.
Yeah.
But it tells you what direction you are from the beacon, not, and it has nothing to do with the direction that your nose of your airplane is pointed. You have to use your magnetic compass and turn to a heading that will take you to the station based on the information you're given.
Got it.
Now, the other thing you can do, which is really nice with two VOR stations, is you can tune in two different VOR stations that you can hear and take the from radial, and you can draw from the VORs on your map a line on the from radial that your CDI indicator indicates. And if you draw two lines, they will intersect, and where they intersect is your location. So you can very quickly tell where you are exactly by taking two readings from two VOR stations and then plotting them on your chart, because you know that you're somewhere on that line, that from radial of the VOR. And there you can locate yourself. And they have computers on board aircraft called area navigation systems that can do that for you automatically, and even display on a moving map display where you are. Now, the next thing that you need to know is you have to test the VOR before you take off if you're going to fly in instrument conditions. And that's called a visual omni-range test signal, and they're at all major airports. So you tune it in, and your VOR should center at 0 degrees and 180 degrees, and you check to see if it does that. And if it's within 4 degrees, then you can legally fly IFR. But you have to test it each time before you take off if you're going to fly in cloud and follow instrument flight rules. Now, the next nav aid is often used in conjunction with the VOR, and it's called distance measuring equipment. And it's usually co-located at the same ground station as the VOR. And it sends out a pulse, and the pulse is timed from a device in your aircraft, and it times how long it takes for the pulse to get there, and it measures the distance between the station and you. So you have a readout that says you are on, let's say, the 90-degree radial of the VOR, and it'll tell you how many nautical miles out you are. It'll say, oh, you're 50 miles out. And so as you fly inbound to the station, if that's what you're doing, you can know exactly how far out you are and calculate when you're going to arrive over that VOR station. So that's distance measuring equipment. So anyway, it's a little more complicated than that, but I don't want to get too deep into it. But the device in the plane and the device on the ground send pulses to each other and do timing, and therefore you can figure out how far out you are. Now, the next system that I'm going to talk about is the instrument landing system. And the instrument landing system sends out a set of signals such that when you're off the end of a runway, this same kind of CDI indicator that's used on VOR will tell you if you are left or right of the center line of the runway. I'm not going to go into the electronics of how it works, but again, it's a phase measuring system, and it will tell you if you're on the center line, if you're to the left or to the right, and again, if you're inbound to an ILS system, you turn towards the needles. And if you want to try it out in your flight simulator, you can set up an ILS approach. And what you do is simply turn towards the needle, and that will get you on the center line of the runway. Now, that's the call the localizer half of the instrument landing system. There's a second signal that is called the glide path signal, and it tells you whether you're above or below a 3-degree glide path that'll bring you down to the end of the runway. And by the way, this ILS system is the system that's used at almost all of the major airports in the Western world to bring aircraft down to a safe landing in bad weather. So you have the localizer, which tells you if you're left or right of center line, and you have the glide path, which tells you whether you're above or below the glide path that will bring you down to the end of the landing end of the runway. So that's instrument landing system, or ILS. Now, in addition to those signals on the instrument landing system, you usually have beacons that you can tune in on your ADF and tell when you pass over them, or there's another kind of fan beacon, and there's little lights that light up on your instrument panel that flash when you go over these beacons. So you, again, it's a confirmation of how far out you are, and usually they're at critical points where you have to make decisions of whether you're going to continue the approach and land, or whether it's time to pull up and shoot what's called a missed approach. So you do that based on beacons and or ADF beacons that are in line with the runway that you're landing on.
Are there beacons that the plane has that the air traffic control signals in on? Is there, you know, any kind of that the air traffic control knows where the planes are by particular signals that the planes themselves give off?
Yes, that's a different system. They have both, the air traffic control has both what's called primary and secondary radar. Primary radar simply bounces a signal off of the metallic aircraft,
right,
and from that can know where it is. But more important, there's secondary radar that works in concert with a transponder that's in the aircraft. Now, the transponder in the aircraft, when it picks up the secondary radar signal, it sends back a digital signal that uniquely identifies that airplane, and it also sends back the altitude of the airplane. So the air traffic and control can know where you are when you're coming in near the airport, yeah, and know how, what altitude you're at. So yes, that's how air traffic control knows where you are. It's a separate system from the ILS or any of these other nav aids.
Okay.
But there is a secondary radar that gets this digital information and exactly, you know, tells everybody where you are.
Cool.
The next system I was going to talk about is the one that's kind of taking over for all of these, and that's the GPS, Global Positioning System. And the way it works is there's a constellation of satellites up there. I think the total's 32. There's usually as many as 8 or 9, 10 satellites in sight, and they have super precision clocks in them, and they send out these very special encoded signals, and a handheld GPS or a GPS in a plane can time these signals and compare the signals from multiple satellites and figure out exactly where it is in three space, both the latitude, longitude, and altitude of an aircraft or a marine vessel or a car, for that matter. So the interesting thing is, if you go back in the history of the show, I did a whole show on GPS, and I did a show explaining that the clocks in these satellites have to be corrected for relativity. Einstein's theory of relativity, both special relativity and general relativity, you have to correct for the mass of the Earth and the fact that the satellite is further out from the mass of the Earth than a clock that is on the surface of the Earth, and that it is traveling in an orbit much faster than a clock on the ground. So before the satellite is launched, they have to correct the rate of the satellite clock system to correct for relativity. So if you're using a GPS system, you are proving every day that Einstein's theory of relativity is true. If you don't correct for it, you can be as much as 1 kilometer off. And, of course, GPS can get you now with the WASP system. It can get you accurate to within 10 feet. Now, let me tell you, I think it's a funny story about GPS. The GPS system, when it first came out, it was launched by the military. And so they had a military signal and they had a civilian signal. And when they first launched the GPS system, they said, oh, the way we've got it set up, people can't figure out where they are with the commercial signals, the non-encrypted signals. The military signals were encrypted, so no one could receive them but the military. But they said the civilian signals, the best accuracy you can get is 300 feet. So, you know, that's good. We don't want civilians navigating any more accurately than that. And when they first put out civilian receivers, they were able to get much better accuracy. There was some special algorithms that the commercial designers used, and suddenly they could get the accuracy down to about 30 feet. Well, the military went berserk. They said, we don't want this. So the next constellation of satellites they put up had what was called selective availability, and they actually deviated the signal on purpose in a pseudo-random fashion so that it would put a 300-foot air, a typical average 300-foot air, to any civilian user. So the civilians didn't like that. So
I want to know where I am.
Right.
Like I don't want my phone telling me I'm in a parking lot when I'm actually on a freeway headed south at 60 miles an hour, you know?
So the next thing that happened is the government, the same government, U.S. government, that's working with the U.S. military.
By the people, for the people.
Right. The civilians in the government said, well, let's put in the special, what they call differential ground stations. Basically, at every major city, every major port, every major airport, they put in a little receiving station. And, of course, they know where it is. It's not moving, all right? And it listens to the satellite signals, and it measures this selective availability signal, and it then transmits it on a VHF. I think it was I can't remember. It transmitted that air signal out to all of the GPS systems in the vicinity and said, hey, you know, the signal you're getting has this air in it, subtract it out. And suddenly they could get accurate to about 10 feet. Well, finally, somebody in Congress woke up and they said, well, now just a minute, let's get this straight. The military is paying good money to make the signal vary all over the place. And we here in Congress are voting money to defeat the military's selective availability variation in the signal. Something's wrong here. You know, why should we do this? So finally, during the Bill Clinton administration, they turned off selective availability. They said, this is ridiculous. You know, one part of the government's trying to fake everybody out, and the other part of the government's trying to defeat the fake out. So
it sounds typical.
Yeah. Let's not do this. So they turned off selective availability. And since then, they have instigated another system that makes the whole system even more accurate for civilians. Keep in mind, they can turn all this off and on at any time if a war breaks out. So what they did is they added WASS, W-A-S-S, Wide Area Augmentation System. And instead of putting in stations that work very locally at large cities and airports, they scattered a bunch of ground stations across North America. There's some in Canada, the U.S., and so forth. And again, they know where they are. And so they listen to the signals of the GPS satellites, and they measure any errors. And this is not that the selective availability was turned off, so that got you an accuracy of around 30 feet. And then with this WASS system, they measured errors even smaller than that, and they send those errors back up in real time to a geostationary satellite that sends them back down directly to your handheld GPS receiver or your aircraft GPS receiver. And it subtracts out the errors, and now you get accuracies of 10 feet again. So that's the history of the government, causing the signal to be bad on purpose, the government defeating that system, somebody finally waking up and saying it's silly to spend money defeating a system we're paying for. And then finally they said, hey, let's make it really good and put in yet another system called WASS that brings it to the state that it's in today. Now, I have to tell you one other funny story.
So, but before you go there, is the military and the civilian GPS fairly comparable at this point then, or is military
better? Yeah. The military can still do things that the civilian can, but the civilian's much better than it was.
Right.
Now, I have to tell you the one funny thing. Cool. During the first Gulf War, at that time, they had selective availability turned on during the first Gulf War. So that, you know, that made the thing inaccurate to 300 feet on purpose. Ugh. Well, when they started the Gulf War, they didn't have enough military receivers that could receive the military signal. So that was the first hot war that the U.S. had been involved in, at that time after GPS went up, and they had this selective availability signal on. So they rushed out before they invaded Iraq the first time, when they went into Kuwait. This is the first Gulf War. And they bought a whole bunch of civilian receivers and handed them out to the military because they didn't have enough military ones. And so they said, well, gee, these civilians are, receivers are going to be out by 300 feet. And they said, okay, no problem. We'll turn off selective availability, and then they'll be good to 30 feet. So during the first Gulf War, during a war, they turned off selective availability. As soon as the war was over, they turned it back on. Think about this a while. All right.
I love it.
Oh, my. But at any rate, that all of that is true. That all happened in the history of GPS. So at any way, that sums up in a nutshell what GPS can do. Now, in aircraft now, they're starting to work on approaches that allow you to use nothing but GPS to approach and land at an airport. It isn't quite as high a precision as ILS yet, but they're working on it, and they're working on approving this. Now, back about 20 years ago, I took a course on GPS because the company I was working for wanted to use GPS in one of its projects. And at that time, they told me that they would discontinue ILS and VOR navigation within 2 or 3 years of me taking that course. Now, that was 20 years ago. All I've got to say is they're still using ILS, they're still using VOR, they're still using ADF, and they're using GPS. So it hasn't, those older navigation systems have not yet been completely replaced. They're still right. Promising that they will be someday. So we'll have to see. Now, let's talk about the future. If you, by the way, if you have questions or ideas for the show, please send them to me at ray@twit.tv. So that's ray@twit.tv. So that's ray@twit.tv. Send me your comments, your suggestions, etc. Next week, I if all goes well, I'm going to be talking to you. The name of the program is going to be The Density of Hot Air. And somebody's going to say, oh, my, he's talking about how much he talks. No.
Nobody said that.
No, we're going to be talking about hot air balloons next week and what makes them fly and what skills you need and how you get a hot air balloon rating and what you can and cannot do with hot air balloons. And in the future, we're going to be talking about remotely piloted vehicles, flying like twins, float flying, RC model aircraft. And I'm trying to get a friend of mine to come on as an expert on helicopters. He knows a lot about helicopters. He makes his living writing about for a lot of aviation journals. And he is an expert witness who testifies in court whenever there's an accident involving helicopters. So I'm trying to line up him as a guest on our show in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to learning about why these things can fly.
Yeah.
they are just the brute force. We will be in the air kind of vehicles. I can't say that I have a goal to ever be in a helicopter.
You've never been up in one?
No, they seem a little bit dangerous. They should be on the ground.
Well, I have a few hours in a helicopter, but I certainly don't have a helicopter rating.
Right.
And I have flown in them numerous times. The only bad thing about it, I mean, I love helicopters. The only bad thing about them is they're the most expensive means of transportation per seat mile of anything on Earth. You have to have a very, very special reason for wanting to use a helicopter.
Yes, like being a weatherman or a news reporter or you're carrying platoons of people into Vietnam, you know.
Yeah, or landing on oil derricks offshore.
Yes, yes.
That sort of thing. So that's what we're going to do next week. Next week's going to be hot air balloons.
I'm excited about that. That'll be great. I love it. Because growing up in the Central Valley, the hot air balloons in the spring and summer mornings, they always take off from very nice flat parts of the valley. And so they are a fixture in the Central Valley sky here in California.
Yep.
So I'd love to hear more about them. That'll be cool, Ray.
Yep.
Very cool. So I guess with that, that's it for another episode, yes?
That's it.
Wow. Another hour come to the end.
Has flown by.
It's flown by. Exactly. And I hope that everybody learned a lot about navigation and navigating in a plane using all of the instruments that are available to pilots. The last two episodes have been full of information, and I can't say that I'll be able to get into a cockpit and know what to do, but
I can just see it.
Figure the stuff next, out.
The next airline flight you're on, you know, they'll say, the two pilots have just gotten sick. Is there anyone here who knows how to fly it? And Dr. Kiki, well, I know how.
Me. I listened to Maxwell's House. That's dangerous. Disclaimer. Just because you're learning from Ray does not mean you can fly a plane.
That's right. We're just giving you the theory.
You have to
practice like anything else. It takes lots of practice.
That it does. So I hope in the next week, everybody practices thinking about listening to Maxwell's House and visiting us to watch next week. Next week, Ray is going to be on at 3:30 Pacific time. The times are changing. So next week, instead of 2 p.m., 3:30 p.m. Pacific time for Maxwell's House. Don't forget, be there. And you can always find Maxwell's House on the twit.tv website. Thanks for watching, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you soon.